Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say he liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. This past Friday night, ABC's 2020 aired the story of 19-year-old Jessica Blodgett, who was murdered in her Hartford home on July 15th of 2013. Joining us is Jesse's dad, Dr. Buck Blodgett. And Buck, first of all, let's talk a little bit about Jessica. What kind of a kid was she?
Oh my gosh, I can't sum her up in words. Can't sum anybody up in words, but she was exceptional in a lot of ways. She was really bright. In first grade, her first spelling word was metamorphosis. And then her second
one. I can't spell that now.
Yeah, she was kind of like a star student. Near straight A student in the Honors College at UWM her freshman year. She didn't know what to do with her life at first, and I think because of me, she went into the teacher certification program to become a teacher. Well, she got kind of discovered in a karaoke bar over the summer after freshman year by Professor Arante in the Peck School of the Arts, and she was offered a prestigious talent scholarship in the Peck School of the Arts, and so she came home one day and told me she switched her major. I thought, oh no, she's going to be a starving musician, and I was so wrong. She started her own business 2 months before she was killed. She had 28 students come into our house to take voice, piano, or violin lessons from her every week. But that wasn't the best stuff about her. You know, her friends will tell you the best stuff about her. She loved to debate the big issues of life and the world. And they had some rip-roaring debates. But her friends will tell you, though she made them really mad sometimes, they always felt loved and like they were wanted. And she wanted to know what they thought, even though it was different than what she thought.
I want to go back to her musical talent, because you said that she was discovered, she was already in college, but she must have shown some interest and talent in music when she was young.
Oh, she did. Her grandpa gave her a starter keyboard in first grade, and I thought, I'm going to have to take piano lessons with this kid. It's finally my chance, because I always wanted to play guitar my whole life. And I started with her, and then I got super busy at work, and after like a couple months, and I thought I got to take a couple months off. Hopefully she'll still go. And by the time I came back, she was off to the races. She was way ahead of me and I just dropped out. And she was, I don't know about gifted, but her voice was gifted. She had an incredible, sweet, soft, clear upper register, but a powerful voice. Her music was soulful. She wrote a lot of her own music. In fact, some of her friends called her an old soul. Pretty talented kid.
So she must have, in high school and things like that, been participating in choral,
yes,
theater.
Yep, choir, orchestra, all the state solo ensemble competitions, all the forensics meets, all the theater arts, the performing arts, all the talent shows. That was her thing. She won the talent show in middle school and in high school. And she loved music, but it was more than that for Jessie. Music was going to be her way that she was going to make her mark in life and impact the world and people.
Did she want to be a performer, or was she more about teaching young people to use their talents?
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody loves attention. I'm not going to say she didn't, but I don't think that was the main thing. I think the main thing was, A, just musically, just making beautiful music. But more importantly than that, making meaningful music. We actually found in her 11th grade lit notebook after she passed something she wrote that, far as I know, nobody ever knew or read except for her, because she wrote it. Her mom texted it to me. Joy texted it to me months after the murder. She'd been going through her stuff. And it said, music is a uniting art, a universal language, a way to change the world. She saw music as her vehicle, how she was going to get something done in life.
You said that she liked to debate and she liked those current events and wanted to talk about them. And she had a passion for social justice.
She did. She found PETA online in sixth grade, and I watched her turn from a kid into a conscious human being. And it was cool as her dad to go on that ride with her. She blossomed. Her first cause, you know, Joy and I had to watch slaughterhouse videos and Georgia chicken factory workers pitching live chickens against the factory walls, and they'd explode in a cloud of feathers and dark, bad stuff, especially for a kid, but she was outraged by it. And so she became fierce about the ethical treatment of animals. And that morphed into like a new cause every year. First, it was vegetarianism in seventh grade. And she went on a choir trip to Washington, D.C. and came back looking anorexic because she refused to eat half the places they stopped, because those places she knew to be places that didn't get their meat from sources that treated animals as ethically as possible. And then she became a Buddhist in eighth grade for a few months because of their reverence for every living thing and their daily practice of breathing in the suffering of the world and exhaling love back into the world, and just went on from there. Ironically, her last big cause in life was male and female violence, she called it. She found out about it in 10th grade. And the last 3 years of her life, she was a crusader for, you know, bringing that to the public light and doing something about it.
When she was in high school, did she have a lot of friends?
Yes. After she passed, you know, I knew she had a lot of friends, but I didn't realize how many. I didn't realize how big her circle was. She not only had a lot of friends, she had different pods of friends in high school. There was the winter camping group, and there's the theater arts group, and then there's her core friend group, Ian and Jackie and Amelia and some others. But she had a friend from Green Bay, and she had a friend from Wausau. And then when she went to UWM, at her funeral, I met a bunch of her UWM friends. And she had a friend on the south side of Milwaukee who used to have concerts in his basement. And me and his dad somehow met years later because his dad does work like I do. And we're like, what? That's your kid? Each of us. And she's had friends everywhere. Very fearlessly social, loving, sensitive young person.
Did she have a lot of boyfriends?
She had three, I believe. Kind of one a year. First one was in freshman year of high school. Second one was in sophomore year. And then Josh was my favorite. He was junior year, if I remember right. She stayed friends with all of them. The first one made that difficult. The first one turned out to be, Dan turned out to be the one who would 4 years later, kill her.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Goes in her bedroom, talking to her, still no response. Gets a little closer, gets a sense that something's not right.
Dr. Buck Blodgett tells how his wife discovered his murdered daughter's body.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Dr. Buck Blodgett, the father of murder victim Jessica. You've alluded to this, and I know it's going to be difficult, but what happened on July 15th of 2013? She had just been in a play, hadn't she?
Yeah, she was between opening weekend and the second weekend of Fiddler on the Roof.
And she had a really key part in that play.
She won the title role. She was the fiddler. It was her first community theater out of high school. She was in all the plays and musicals in high school, but this was her first community theater, and I was, needless to say, pretty proud of her. She got some little role, and she happened to go to Jerry, the director of the Hartford Players, and tell him, you know, I play violin, and she ended up being the fiddler.
So she won this role. She was in Fiddler on the Roof, and she, as you said, was the title character. Did you see her at that performance? Because wasn't that the debut night, the 14th?
Opening weekend, they have Friday night, they perform Saturday night, and then the Sunday matinee. And then they have the traditional late night cast party that they all went to Sunday night.
Did you get to see her perform?
I did. I saw her once on opening weekend, unfortunately. Couldn't go to all three of them. And then I saw them again the weekend after she passed, which they dedicated to her.
So let's go back to that weekend. And like you said, I know that's one of the things about kids in theater groups is they love the camaraderie of those cast parties. And like you said, that opening weekend, they had a big one that night.
Yeah, they had a big one. Jessie called them her second family. That's how bonded they were in a short amount of time. And in fact, so deep that the second weekend after it happened, they debated hard whether they were going to call it off. And somebody said, no, Jess would want the show to go on. And everybody knew they were right about that, so they did it anyways. But they didn't have a fiddler. All the violin parts where the fiddler sits on the roof and plays, they just had a candle lit on the roof, and they left that whole part silent in honor of Jessie.
When she went to the party that night, she was disturbed because weren't there a couple of guys that were hitting on her?
Yeah, there were. She came home, and I was asleep. Mom being mom, Joy couldn't sleep until Jess came home. She's 19 now. You know, she's not a fourth grader anymore. She's 19, but mom still couldn't sleep. So she was awake when Jess came home, and Jess didn't seem her usual boisterous, happy self, and something was bothering her. So she asked about it, and Jess talked to her about how a couple guys were, you know, she thought for a 19-year-old girl, and these were older men who were in the play, she wasn't comfortable. It wasn't like anything bad happened or anything illegal happened or any such thing, but she wasn't comfortable, and she told her mom.
What was the last time you talked to Jessica?
Well, it was the day before, and I don't even remember the last conversation, the time of day. What's etched in my brain permanently is the phone call that every parent fears that I got when I was at work that day. And what's etched in my brain permanently is that I never got the chance to say goodbye, tell her I loved her, and tell her I'd never stop loving her, and tell her I'm sorry for not being there when she needed her dad to be there.
Going back to that night when she came home and she talked to her mom and told her what had happened at the cast party, I'm sure your wife would have comforted her and told her, hey, you know, thanks for telling me. But you all went to bed that night.
Yeah, well, I slept right through it all, but they did, yes.
And the next morning, you and your wife both got up for work.
Yep. I got up and left first, and then Joy left after me, and Jess was sleeping in for the first time that all summer. This is halfway through summer, but it's her first chance to sleep in because she was pooped from being the fiddler and the fiddler on the roof and the push to opening weekend and then the three performances and the cast party. She also got a job that started the day after she finished her freshman year at UWM, and it was a limited-term summer job that had just ended. She got up really early every morning and worked at our local rec center for 6 weeks, and it had just ended the Friday of opening weekend on the fiddler. So this was her first chance to sleep in. And, of course, Dan, who was welcome in her home and one of her friends, and was just over the week before, he knew all of this. He knew our schedules and her schedule and that she'd be sleeping in.
So your wife came home for lunch that day.
Yeah.
What happened?
She called up to Jess, and there wasn't an answer, and she didn't think much of it, except she was a little irritated because it's 12 o'clock now, and come on, kid, I know you've been working hard, but I also know you're a teenager, and it's time to be out of bed. It's noon. No answer. I think she called up again about 5 minutes later. Now, Joy had to make and eat a quick lunch and then get back to patients, but she looks out the picture window. We have a long drive. We're going down to the road, and she sees a six-year-old piano student of Jesse's walking up the driveway, so she knows the student's coming for his 12:30 lesson. So now she calls up to Jess, and there's still no answer. And she runs up the stairs, Jesse. You know, she's a little mad because Jess isn't ready for her piano lesson. It's her business. Goes in her bedroom, talking to her, still no response. Gets a little closer, gets a sense that something's not right. Reaches out to wake her, you know, to tug on her shoulder or roll her or whatever and wake her up, and Jesse's cold. And then she rolls her over and Jesse's blue. And there's a phone on the nightstand right next to Jesse's bed, ironically, which apparently she never could get to. And she calls 911 immediately and starts CPR, which she did for about 10 minutes, I think, until they got there.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Our neighborhood was full, and my driveway was full. Our house was full of about, I don't know how many people, 30 people, first responders of all kinds.
Dr. Buck Blodgett describes walking into the house when investigators' eyes all turned towards him.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Dr. Buck Blodgett. When the police arrived, did anybody know immediately what had happened to Jesse?
No, nobody knew. There was no outwardly clear signs of violence, so it took a while. But her room was a crime scene, and only the detectives were in it once Joy left after the EMTs got there and she called me. Detective Thickens was the lead investigator, and he was amazing. The way he treated us was amazing. He asked a lot of questions. You know, he'd come down and ask some questions, go back up, come down 20 minutes later, ask some more questions, go back up. And there was questions about the cords on the drapes and stuff like that. And Joy had seen marks on Jesse's neck. And they later, after they had secured her room as a crime scene and checked her more, they also found ligature marks on her wrists and on her ankles. And they saw the marks that Joy was talking about on her neck, so they knew right then. We didn't know right away because they weren't saying anything for a while, but they did.
What did you think had happened to her?
I didn't know.
You must have been in shock.
I was in shock, number one. My drive home was a little over half hour. And we have different memories of this, but my memory of it is when she said, honey, it's Jesse. And I said, what? And she tried to explain a little bit, but she was sobbing a lot. And frantic isn't the right word. She was very present and focused, but, you know, also in shock and traumatized. And she explained that she did CPR and she called 911 and they're here now taking over for me. And the first thing she did was call me. And I said, is she responding? And Joy just sobbed and didn't say anything. And then I thought I heard her say no. And I said, honey, is she? And I didn't want to say the word dead. So I said, is she gone? And then Joy broke down sobbing, and my memory didn't say anything else. So I didn't really know for that whole drive home. I didn't know until I got home, and our neighborhood was full, and my driveway was full. Our house was full of about, I don't know how many people, 30 people, first responders of all kinds, from sheriff's department to Hartford PD to DA's office personnel and a crime scene unit truck.
When did it hit you?
When I saw Joy in the living room, it took me a minute to get there through all the people. All the people who stopped and just their head. I mean, they're in the middle of an investigation and they're checking everything everywhere in my house. And as I walked through, it was so surreal and weird. All these strangers, I didn't know who they were, would just stop and turn their head and look at me as I walked through. And I just walked through my house looking for Joy. And I found her in the living room. As soon as I saw her, I knew that Jess was gone. I didn't know what happened until Joy told me, as we sat on the couch all day, she would tell me some things and they would come down and ask some questions, and all of it kind of added up to somebody harmed her, you know, ligature marks, somebody did something. You know, the police have to rule out everything. So they're thinking, you know, did this person harm themselves? Did she strangle herself? Was it suicide? But, you know, this, that. Who were the suspects? Those were a lot of the questions. Who are possible suspects? And we all watch TV. We know that family is the first suspect, people who are closest to them, because that often is what happens. Yeah, just a lot of crazy stuff.
I mean, did you feel that they were looking at you as a possible suspect?
I never felt that from them, but of course I thought that. Actually, on my ride home, that was one of the million thoughts that went through my brain on that half-hour drive that seemed like a lifetime and seemed like 5 seconds all somehow at the same time.
You've now lost your daughter. And again, anyone who loses somebody unexpectedly, not even to mention the circumstances this were under, you still have to go through the process. You have to take care of them. You've got to plan a funeral. It must have been so difficult. I mean, I'm assuming you didn't have any sort of things planned, pre-planning or anything like that.
Yeah, no, you assume right. Never occurred to me. So, yeah, the whole thing was surreal. I had this sensation that I still can't describe. I think just because words can't describe it, of time stopping. And that lasted literally 3 days. I didn't eat for 3 days, didn't sleep for 3 nights, didn't need to, didn't want to. It was just all about Jesse and what was happening.
But you had to pull it together. You had to have that funeral for her.
Yeah. You know, people guided us through the process. Family came, friends came. People took over arranging, gathering all pictures off all the friends' laptops and all that stuff. And my brother took the lead with that. Joy and I went to the Shimon Funeral Home in Hartford, and the director led us through that process and cremation or burial and, you know, what kind of vase do you want for the ashes and all that stuff. And just really weird.
And yet at that point, there was an investigation going on.
Yes, there was an investigation going on for 16 days until they had the press conference on the 16th day.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
She said, "What's the matter, Dan?" And he said, "Well, the police just called."
Dr. Buck Blodgett describes how the killer received a call from police while at Jessica's vigil.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Buck Blodgett, whose daughter Jessica was murdered in her home in Hartford in 2013. When did you start to plan Jessica's funeral?
It actually started the night of her murder. What happened was, I was waiting all day to see her. They finally release her room and her as a crime scene, and I get to see her for 30 seconds and touch her, and then boom, they're out the door and the coroner takes her away. And it was like, wait, what? That was my moment. And so I'm staring out the picture window, and I have no idea to this day for how long, but it was a long time because it got dark. And at one point, all the way down by the road, the apple trees, like 140 feet down the hill from the house, I think I see movement. Well, it's Jesse's friends are starting to spontaneously gather at my house. Our families didn't come that first day. My friends, Joy friends didn't come. I'm not blaming them. I think nobody knew what to do. I think everybody was in shock, and maybe they were giving us space that first day. Jesse's friends didn't know or care what the right thing to do was. They just showed up at my house, and we just loved hard on each other like I've never seen that night. And maybe they saved me that night, and I might have saved a couple of them. I don't know. I hope so. Then they stayed. Joy couldn't sleep in the house because our bedroom was 20 feet from where it all happened, in Jesse's bedroom. And we went to bed, and then she lays down, and within seconds she goes, "Honey, I can't. We got to go somewhere." So we go to the American, about a minute away. But the kids stayed in our house, and we just let them. Then apparently they all left like well after midnight. And the next day they all came back. And then our friends and our families did too. And every day, all week long, from the Monday of the murder to the Saturday of the funeral, our house filled up every day with people like that. And so the first vigil was just that, a spontaneous gathering at our house. And all of her friends were sitting in a circle in our living room, a couple dozen of them, and sharing hugs and tears and memories. And Dan was in that circle.
This is the first boyfriend from her freshman year of high school.
Yeah.
That she stayed in contact with.
Yeah. Just for the record, I believe this is important. This was not traditional breakup violence, like if I can't have her, nobody will. Dan broke up with Jesse, was a little mean to her, at least from her dad's point of view, for a while after, because she still liked him. And I think he was making things clear, basically, in a teenage kind of a way. But Jesse believed in lifelong relationships and friendships, and she worked hard at that with all of her friends, including her two other boyfriends and also with Dan. And so eventually I think she kind of won them over that they were friends.
So he was there with the rest of her friends.
Yeah.
And while he was there, his phone rang.
Yeah. I didn't see it. I didn't hear his phone, but Joy did. And Joy said he seemed like something was wrong. So she went over to him to support him. And she said, "What's the matter, Dan?" And he said, "Well, the police just called. It's something about a van. They think my van is involved in something." This, by the way, had nothing to do with Jesse's murder. This had to do with an attack on Melissa in Richfield County Park 3 days before he killed Jesse. He attacked Melissa with a 15-inch kitchen knife.
Now, he goes to the police station directly from this vigil for your daughter.
We heard this call in court, and it was fascinating. We saw a video of it. The officer had incredible presence of mind. He said, "Dan, thanks for coming in. You're not under arrest. You're not in any trouble. Would you just help us with this van thing, answer some questions for us?" And Dan said, "Yep, I'll come right in." He said, "Where are you coming from?" He said, "From the Blodgett house." Crickets. "The Blodgett house, isn't that girl in Hartford?" And Dan said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh, yeah." The detective said, "What happened to her?" And Dan said, "She was raped and murdered." Nobody knew at the time she was raped. The police actually told us there didn't appear to be a sexual assault, just strangulation. And then DNA showed a couple weeks later that there had been.
And he said that to the police.
He said that to the police.
Standing in your home.
Yeah.
So they brought him in.
They brought him in. He's
and
never
they
been out.
Questioned him about this other assault. Then the woman survived, correct?
Melissa fought him off, yes. He attacked her from behind. 210-pound man, 110-pound 19-year-old girl. She's laying face down in the gravel with Dan on her back and his arms around her and the 15-inch knife underneath her. They'd fallen down that way. She says, "I don't remember anything else until we're standing up facing each other and I have the knife." Melissa's holding it. She's got 17 stitches in her hand. She literally grabbed the blade and wrestled it away from him. She said, "He said the weirdest thing. He said, 'Can I just go now?'" And Melissa said, "No." And he turned and ran, bolted to his van, peeled out of the lot. She couldn't see the plate, but she had the amazing whatever to identify. The police sketch artist called it the best description she'd ever got by a victim of violence. She identified the van, its color, its make, its model, and guessed within 1 year of this 10-year-old van. And there's another backstory to this, but basically it took them 4 days on that information to track him down, which of course was 1 day too late for Jesse.
He was arrested for this, but the police at the time began to think there could have been a connection to Jesse's murder.
Yeah, as soon as they heard the Blodgett house, you could see the wheel spinning in his head on the video we saw in court. So he was interrogated regarding the attack in the park, and then the Washington County Sheriff called the Hartford PD and said, "I think I might have a person of interest here in the Jesse Blodgett case." The next day, Detective Thickens came. Dan had already asked for an attorney, at which point you must stop questioning them according to Miranda law until their attorney's present. But Thickens came the next day and said, "Hey, we got this different case. Can I ask you some questions about this?" And Dan agreed. And it's been debated and ruled by an appellate court, the state Supreme Court, and then apparently the United States Supreme Court, who decided not to hear the case. All of them apparently agreed that his Miranda rights were honored and not violated.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Astonishment might be a better word. Like, what happened to Dan? How could he have done this?
Dr. Buck Blodgett describes his reaction when the police told him his daughter's friend was the killer.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Dr. Buck Blodgett. I'm your host, Libby Collins. When did you find out that they had arrested Jessica's friend, Dan, as a suspect in her murder?
Thursday morning at the police station, the third day after she was killed. Thickens came to our house Monday and then Tuesday again and then Wednesday again for follow-up questions. Then Thursday, he didn't come. He was done asking us questions. When I got up Thursday morning, it was like deafening silence on steroids. We went from a family of six to a family of two because we had to put down three animals that same year. I couldn't take it. So I said to Joy, can we go to the police station and visit with Thickens and see if he'll tell us more about what's happening? So we did. In real time, the investigation is unfolding in Woodlawn Park, where they found the cereal box with all the evidence in it. But he sat with us for, my memory is, about 2 hours. And he was on and off his phone and his radio because he's the lead investigator and he's taking calls and getting reports and this is happening. We didn't know anything about what was happening except he kept excusing himself. And near the end of this, he excuses himself. And me and Joy are just sitting in his office and there's someone sitting behind us who had just come in a few minutes earlier. I didn't know at the time who that person was. It turns out he's now the chief of police of Hartford, Scott McFarland, who was Thickens' boss back at that time. And he just kind of came in and sat down with the three of us and kind of honored the mood of the room or whatnot and didn't add anything. But when Thickens left, we're just sitting there. And so in the awkward silence with this stranger, I turned to him and I say, hey, this is the third day in a row that he's led with a question about Dan. Because every time Thickens had asked us questions, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, he said, tell me about Dan. And we're like, Dan's a good kid. Dan's Jesse's friend. Dan's welcome in our home. He's never been in trouble, as far as we know, with the school or with the law. Straight A student, a lot of friends, popular with the boys, popular with the girls, very talented. I said, what's up with that? And he said, haven't we told you yet? Dan's under arrest. And then he starts to lay out the evidence. And the big thing that I heard was they found a roll of Intertape 68 in the gravel parking lot where he attacked Melissa. They found another roll of Intertape 68 in his van. They found a half-empty box of it in his dad's basement. This tape is used in home ventilation systems. And it's really not very common. Like at trial, the police tried to go buy some sample copies and they couldn't find any in all the hardware stores in Washington County. That's how uncommon it is. Well, there's a roll in the parking lot where he attacked Melissa, a roll in his van, a bunch in his dad's basement, and found another roll under Jesse's bed. And when I heard that, I knew it was Dan.
I can't even begin to imagine what your reaction and your wife's reaction must have been.
Well, see if I can begin to describe it, because it's the key to why I'm here today. My reaction and Joy's reaction, we had, I believe, the exact same reaction. And it wasn't hate, and it wasn't anger, and it wasn't, give me 5 minutes with a baseball bat with this kid in the woods. It wasn't anything like that. It was concern. It was not disbelief. It was astonishment, might be a better word. Like, what happened to Dan? How could he have done this? What's so wrong in his brain and his heart that nobody knew that he would be capable of doing this to our Jesse and his friend? So it was genuine concern. It wasn't forgiveness in that moment, but it was a kind of a forgiving spirit, kind of a caring understanding. Because remember, at the same time we were in shock and grief and pain, there was this overwhelming love happening in my house. And it turned out that was happening all over the whole community. And I haven't described that well yet, but I was in this dual presence of amazing shock and amazing love. And it was in that that we reacted that way. Hard to explain. But a couple weeks of
that. You weren't angry?
No, I'm still not.
Neither was your wife?
Not at the time, I don't think. She's never said so. I think we both were astonished and confused and concerned.
Did you want to talk to Dan at that time?
Let me be crystal clear. I don't need to talk to Dan. I want him to know and I want everyone to know that my peace and my joy and my life, he doesn't get the power to have any influence or impact. So I don't need to talk to Dan, but I'd love to talk to Dan if I do have a condition. My love is unconditional. But I do have a condition on talking, and that is, you know, don't BS me. Don't call me up to Waupun and pretend like he's been pretending for 12 years. And if he were to do that and pretend for some advantages he might get in prison or whatnot, I'm not interested. But if he were to have a genuine soul reckoning, change of heart or spiritual experience or something like that, I'm all in. My door's always open.
But instead, you've turned this into the Love-Hate Project, and that's where I want to go back. Shortly after Dan was arrested, a lot of those first responders put together a vigil for Jessica and the community.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
It was about a month after Fire Chief Paul Stevens and Sherry, his first responder, who was holding Joy's hand on our sofa when I arrived home that day. About 2 weeks after the murder, he called me and said, we've been thinking about you and your family ever since. and we want to do something healing for not just for you, but actually for the whole community, which was, you know, this never happens in Hartford. There's 3 murders in Hartford in 100 years, and the last one was 25 years before Jesse's. So he said, we have this community gathering in mind, but we won't do it unless it's okay with you. And you're invited, of course, but we'd love to have you there, but we understand if you don't want to be there. And you don't have to do anything. We'll take care of everything. So they put on this, what the press then labeled a vigil. And 500 people showed up and lit candles and walked together for a couple hours all around the mill pond and around a 2-mile course that they had planned. And it was just, you know, I didn't grow up in a family of violence like some people do. And I've always seen the good in people, but I never saw anything like this. It changed me. It changed me forever. This outpouring, this sustained, over-the-top outpouring of love. People did our lawn, you know, for a month, and people brought food. We didn't have to cook for a month. People did our laundry. They filled up our house until the funeral. It was an outpouring like I never saw. And I specifically remember, Libby, one day, about 2 weeks into this, light bulb goes on in the back of Buck's brain, and it basically was, why don't we do this for each other every day? Like, why does it take horrific tragedy to wake us up? Why can't we just wake up and treat each other like this always? Why don't we work as hard at this like we were that week as we do at our jobs? What's more important? Why don't we practice and strengthen our forgiveness muscle and our love muscle like we do with other stuff?
And that's what you do now.
Trying every day.
Your main goal in life is to spread the Love Hate Project.
That's exactly what happened to me. Yes. Like 99% of what I used to care about before this happened, I don't care about anymore. It's amazing what death can do as a blessing if used the right way. It really got my head on straight about what matters and what doesn't matter, what's important and what's not.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
For anybody else, it would have just been cool, little butterfly. But for me, it was like, wait a second. It just grabbed my attention.
Dr. Buck Blodgett describes some of the messages he's received from Jesse.
Now more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Dr. Buck Blodgett from the Love Hate Project. Do you ever feel as if Jesse has somehow communicated to you since her death?
Oh, that's an easy one to answer. Yes. Yeah. You talk about, we might need to reschedule for this one. I did not believe in that kind of stuff, let's put it that way, for 53 years. I mean, I wasn't totally closed off to it, but it seemed like wishful thinking. But I'm just going to say it. She made it crystal clear the morning after, starting the morning after she was murdered, that her body was dead and gone, but she was not. And that happened. There's a whole bunch of long backstories here we probably don't have time for, but started with a crazy little butterfly encounter I had at the bottom of my driveway the day after the murder, which for anybody else would have just been, you know, oh, that's really cool, little butterfly thing. But for me, it was like, wait a second. It just grabbed my attention and my awareness. And I had 24 experiences, shall I say, over that year after Jesse's murder, that the first dozen of them involve butterflies, and not just me, but her friends and my friends, and actually a news reporter who everybody would recognize from this station who came over to our house to interview me, and a chiropractor I never met who saw us on TV and had to share his butterfly story about his deceased love of his life, and my banker who, same thing with her son and his butterflies around his grave and all kinds of stuff. Then it escalated into some really crazy stuff that probably half of our listeners would have a problem with, and half of them might just nod their heads knowingly and go, wow. These things that happened to me, I believe, were answers to a desperate middle-of-the-night prayer the second night after Jesse's murder, when I believe I talked with my maker, and I believe he talked with me. And wow, did I not see what was going to be coming the next year. But, you know, I'm a scientist at heart. You know, I'm a chiropractor for almost 30 years, and I studied fisheries management in school. I've always loved biology and the biological sciences and the earth sciences too. But there is no science that spoke as loudly to me as that stuff that happened that first year, and I'd be a fool to ignore the evidence. So I guess the short answer is yes, I do think she's with me sometimes.
Dr. Buck Blodgett, thank you for sharing this story.
How do I properly thank people who give Jessie, you know, she didn't just lose her life, she lost her voice, which was really important to her. And so you and TMJ have given it back to her for this program and to her dad, who doesn't have her anymore, who only has her story. Obviously, that means a lot to me, so thank you.
You may have seen the 2020 story about 19-year-old Hartford teen Jessie Blodgett's murder, but we talked at length today with her father, Dr. Buck Blodgett, about what the family actually experienced and how they turned tragedy into hope with the Love is Greater Than Hate project. If you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Buck, go to WTMJ.com, and that's where you can also find a link to the Love is Greater Than Hate project website. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.